This week on Wings, the topic is Rosa Luxemburg, one of the most influential political theorists of her day. She lived from 1871 until 1919, when she was assassinated by the newly elected socialist government of Germany. Luxemburg had written that socialism by gradual reform of the capitalist-oriented system would never provide for the needs of the workers, that only revolution could do the job. She was strongly in favor of the innovation of May 1st as International Labor Day. In many countries, it's still a national holiday, but it originated as a day for workers across the globe to stop work and show their collective power. Rosa Luxemburg's life was complicated, but one author boiled it down to a popular book, in fact, a graphic novel. Here are excerpts from an interview with the author of that book, Kate Evans, courtesy of Mitchell Cohen of Community Radio WBAI in New York City.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
So who was Rosa Luxemburg?
Well, she was tiny. She's 101 years older than me, which means she was born in 1871. She's a Jewish-Polish woman. She's only about 4'9", as far as I can work out. And she has a terrible limp, sort of crippled hip. Her family are not poverty-stricken, but they're Jewish, and anti-Semitism's really bad in Tsarist Poland. She's a woman, you know. How is a woman meant to make an independent living for themselves in the 19th century? She decides to be a socialist, and socialism is illegal. And she completely overcomes all of these obstacles, and she becomes a professor, a journalist, an editor, a lecturer, and an uncompromising theorist of how to make society a better place and what's wrong with the economic systems that we have. She was a very good abstract thinker about economics when people weren't really using terms such as gross domestic product or globalization or the military-industrial complex. But from first principles, thinking really hard about the way economics works in society, she came up with some really strikingly original analyses of exactly what's wrong with capitalism and how it then fuels imperialism and globalization and war. There's not very much biographical information about Rosa Luxemburg out there. What there has been, it's been quite poorly written. We're lucky to have her letters, which are sparkling, and some of them are incredibly poetic. She has loads of different lovers. She goes to amazing places, and she has amazing hair. I mean, it was fun.
Most of us in my collective at Stony Brook University back in the late 60s and early 70s, Rosa Luxemburg was our hero. We read many of her political writings, especially the mass strike pamphlet and Reform and Revolution. You quoted from her the same quote that I always use. It's not like picking sausages from the counter of history.
Now I'll quote her back at you. You see, I've learned from history that one should not overestimate the impact that one individual should have. I mean, maybe she shouldn't be your hero, but through learning about her story and through writing her story, I was writing the history of a large social movement. And I don't think I had at all realised how incredibly organised and powerful international socialism was, how much it achieved in the really solid work that 19th century activists did in trying to create a better future.
The way you drew it, this is a book that's not just her words. Your creativity and your imagination in every panel shows all sorts of things that you're assuming went on or projecting went on.
Well, the job of the graphic novelist is to make the story interesting. I build on the historical facts. So you know this guy, Ebert, is going to become president of the Weimar Republic. He's a socialist, and it's just incredible that the people rose up and overthrew their government and put him in charge. So I know he's in the party school, and she's teaching in the party school. He's the student. So I add an imagined conversation between the two of them, which draws out the differences in their approach. I mean, Ebert famously says after the German Revolution happens, I hate revolution like a mortal sin. And that's a very, very different conceptual position from Rosa Luxemburg's. So I introduce a conversation between the two of them just to heighten the dramatic tension and to set up, who is this guy? So at the point when he's elected president, there may be slightly a foreboding sense of this social uprising may have gone off the rails at the point when he's been put in charge.
Especially what happened in Rose's life a month later.
Yeah. The situation is there's a revolution in Germany in November 1918, which I didn't even know. And I studied that subject at school, that particular history. And they didn't say there was a revolution. They said, and then there was an armistice and the World War ended. Not the World War ended because people overthrew their government, which is a bit of a detail to leave out. So then the socialists are in charge in Germany, and then Rosa is a revolutionary socialist leader. So the fact that she gets murdered by her own government is a movie-scale epic betrayal and something of incredible historical significance. I was reading the history books, and then I was going, she just got killed by her own people. That's just, oh my God. And it's amazing to be given a story that has so much inherent drama within it, even though I did have to read a hell of a lot of really boring revolutionary socialism to bring it accurately to life.
Such as what?
Oh God. Well, you studied Rosa Luxemburg as your personal hero, so you probably went through all those really dense texts happily. Maybe there wasn't any Facebook at the time to distract you. It's really hard to get Rosa Luxemburg and break it down into little tweetable quotes. She writes lengthy passages of prose, and some of it is really focused and dynamic and descriptive and poetic, and some of it just goes on and on and on for pages about, for example, other economists whose work I don't know and who aren't relevant. She's talking about the building blocks of economic theory that's got her to where she is now. But what I'm interested in is what relevance her work then has for us now.
Could you give a little bit of the mass strike?
I summarised the mass strike down into a picture of Rosa putting a bedspread over a bed in 1905 Warsaw.
Well, that was important to us when we went through the Occupy movement and in other movements that seemed to just emerge without the leadership of any particular party.
Ah, yeah. The mass strike does not produce the revolution. The revolution produces the mass strike. What she's studying is a country in turmoil. 1905, over half of the European workers in Russia go on strike. There was a demonstration on the Winter Palace where 200,000 people march on the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg to petition the Tsar, and they're asking just to be recognised, that the poverty and the hardship that they're going through is recognised. And the demonstration is fired upon by the troops, and hundreds of people die. And it just galvanizes the country. And the form that activism takes is the mass strike. People down tools and they walk out. And over half the country is on strike. This has parallels with the Arab Spring in Egypt, which also had a mass strike element to it. What's interesting about it is that's not a strike that's being called with a ballot and by a union. And then Rosa was living in Germany. She couldn't live in Russia or in Poland because she would have been arrested immediately, whereas Germany, she had some political freedom to be a socialist. And so she's dealing with trade unions and party political leaders in Germany who are saying, well, when shall we call a mass strike then? Or, well, it would be irresponsible to call a mass strike. And she's going, you don't call a mass strike. Mass strikes happen. This is what happens when there's a tipping point where people come out on the streets, where they realise they have to say it now and they have to say it in person. And one of the ways you do that is by stopping work. And one of the ways you do that is by public protest. And now with social media, we have other ways, more horizontal ways of organising as well. It's really interesting to see how the spontaneity that she's talking about in 1905, how relevant that is when messages can spread so quickly. The mass strike cannot be just called at will. It cannot be made, planned, or decided. Spontaneity plays a great part. And she says as well, it's like you don't have the mass strike and then that's just one thing. It's part of a movement. She's got a lovely sort of sense that she embraces ambiguity in her writing, which is refreshing because things aren't black or white.
You have a much better explanation in the book about how everything contains its own opposite within it. Propels it forward.
We're talking about dialectics here, aren't we? The best bit, I think, of the mass strike. She says, it's a bit of pulsating life of flesh and blood, which is connected with all parts of the revolution with a thousand veins. If sophisticated theory purposes to make a clever dissection of it, it will not perceive the phenomenon in its living essence, but will kill it altogether. And you could see that maybe if you want to talk about Occupy. Are you talking about the events of one day in one street with one set of people? Or are you talking about the significance of Occupy for a movement and a time and a place that is lived by a million different people in a million different ways?
There was a big fight within Occupy movement here in New York and the U.S., and especially in New York because all the leftist groups headquartered here, mm-hmm. that we need a program for Occupy. So there was one section of Occupy that formed themselves into a working group, and they were trying to push everybody else into creating a program, voting on leaders, and that was sort of ignored by a lot of the other people, but it created an interesting tension in the group.
Oh yeah, well maybe you could form yourselves into ists on either side of that. You could be a leaderist group and an ignorist group, and then you could have a big fight. Honestly, I look at the history of 19th century socialism, I do just want to bash their heads together and say, can you not just have some conflict resolution training and sort it all out so we then don't have to have the 20th century and fascism and all of that rubbish? While I think Marx's analysis of capitalism is amazing, and I'm proud to be able to try and popularise that for people who don't have any understanding of the structural problems with capitalism and the possibilities so we can have a better system that safeguards our future and that of the environment and the planet. What we need to do is look intelligently at what the problems are with capitalism and work out how to tackle them on every level and with every strategy. And if we start going, well, I'm a this-ist and you're a that-ist, you're creating walls instead of building bridges.
Do you live in England now?
Yeah, I live in the West Country. I'm a cartoonist. I started as an environmental activist, doing cartoons about the activism that I was involved with. I wrote a book in the 1990s about the Rhodes protest movement, which involved us all living in trees and getting evicted using cherry picker hydraulic platforms. It was crazy, crazy lifestyle.
Did you actually live in a tree yourself?
Oh yeah, I lived in a tree. Yeah, I think it's really funny now. I mean, now I'm like just taking my kids to school and back and going, I actually used to live in a tree.
How long did you live in a tree?
Well, I had a few different trees. There was a tree that was my tree, which is now, it's an open cast coal mine in South Wales. It was a beautiful, beautiful woodland, water meadow, little glen with this little twisty oak tree. So that was kind of my tree. That got chopped down in 1996. And then there was another road that was built in 1998. And I used to sleep in a hammock at the top fork of a branch of a beech tree, 70 foot up. I just look at it now, God, we were nuts in a fun way. If there's any young people out there wondering about whether to get involved in activism, get involved in activism because you make lifelong friends with such sound people. I wrote cartoons giving the personal stories of the people who were involved in the movement, making the political personal and helping people to connect with it in that way. From then, I've moved to various different subjects which have inspired me to write books. I've done one about climate change. I've had children. I've written books about breastfeeding and about birth and about choices within birth. Quite interesting writing about parenting because you can't really make rules. You can't really have a right and a wrong when you write about babies because you always have a baby who'll confound you. That's been good for me personally about embracing ambiguity.
On Wings, you are listening to Kate Evans, creator of the graphic novel Red Rosa, about the life and ideas of early 19th century socialist theorist and labor activist Rosa Luxemburg. Kate is talking with Mitchell Cohen of Community Radio WBAI in New York.
I was offered this Rosa Luxemburg biography opportunity, and it was my first biography, my first historical graphic novel, the first time that I've try to do anything quite so ambitious in terms of drawing, because it's 179 pages and it's drawn throughout. And the first time I got to really play about with narrative and with structure, so that I was creating a work of art based on a person's life. Start with her birth, finish with her death, but also to convey the meaning of what she was writing about in its historical time and its relevance for today.
And if I must say, it's an absolutely brilliant book, both artistically and for a beginner.
Hopefully the fact that it's a graphic novel will make it more popular for people, because people like to read comics. That's why I do what I do. Especially if you can get a bit of humour and you get a bit of drama and get a bit of, you know, life into a story. I mean, I wrote a whole comic format book about climate change. And that is a tough subject to make funny. But again, I used a narrative. I had sort of three main characters and a conversation going between the three of them so that you've got a personal focus for a story and you can have a bit of drama and you can make things funny. That's not too difficult to do with Rosa Luxemburg because she just has some excellent one-liners. There's a bit where the leader of the party is like really worried because she's turned up late to dinner. And he goes, oh, we feared you were lost. It's her and her friend Clara Zetkin. And she goes, oh, really? Imagine the epitaph. Here lie the last two men of social democracy. So basically massively dissing all these male socialist party leaders going, we're the only men here, me and my female friend.
Well, that's one of the things that we missed when we were reading Rosa Luxemburg for her political economic analysis. We knew she was one of the few visible women in the socialist movement, even though the movement was filled with women.
The one who's left a written trace, which means we can re-examine who and what she was. It really helps that Verso has brought out a collected edition of Rosa Luxemburg's letters, and a lot of them are her writing to her lovers. Four different lovers? Yeah. She has a few of them at the same time at some point. And she's talking about what inspires her emotionally and day-to-day events. So you can find out the most lovely little details, like she would save wasps if they got trapped behind a window pane. She would climb up on top of a stack of books and open, like she was tiny, remember? She had a limp, remember? She would open this top window pane and send wasps on their way. Or if she found a little beetle in the grass, she would pick it up. And she'd write letters which I think are almost unsurpassed in the beauty of the poetry of the way in which she approaches life. And a lot of them she writes when she's imprisoned indefinitely for opposing the First World War. The strength of her character to be able to experience such joy and to be able to convey it so poetically when she was in such a dark place, I just think it really shines through. Not only is she trying to do good with her life, not only is she being a really intelligent, indomitable, formidable woman in the face of all these multiple oppressions, but she's also just really funny and really poetic and really beautiful with it. And that's just such an amazing thing to then be able to put the pictures to. There's a beautiful letter where she's writing about an encounter with some water buffalo, which I particularly enjoyed because I never got to draw water buffalo before, and it's always nice to be able to draw different things. I found one little quote about a fly. With every fly that one carelessly swats and crushes, the entire world comes to an end. In the refracting eye of the little fly, it is the same as if the end of the world had destroyed all life. So that's the basis of her respect for other living beings. So I contrast that in the book with some of the quotes that the other people were making about her, because she was a hate figure in the German press at the time because of her ethnicity and because of her gender. She was Bloody Rosa. So the German people are unable to understand why an end is not put to the impertinent behaviour of this female. I put that as the next quote in the book, being while she's revealing how amazingly empathetic she is. Some of the sexism that Rosa Luxemburg experiences is just jaw-dropping. There's a letter between a couple of prominent Socialist Party leaders. One of these guys, August Babel, is he's written a book called Women Under Socialism, which is an early feminist tract. Okay, so he says, "Dear Rosa must not be allowed to spoil our plans. I shall see to it this ridiculous call for a republic will be relegated to obscurity." He sounds like a Bond villain already, yeah? To which Victor Adler says, "The poisonous bitch will yet do a lot of damage. She's as clever as a monkey, yet her sense of responsibility is totally lacking."
These were actual quotes?
These are actual quotes. And I give the actual sources at the back of the book as well, because I think it's really important that people know that all the way through the book, I'm not making up the words that are coming out of people's mouths. These are things written in a letter. So I change the context, so I show them coming out of their mouths. But it's lovely to have that kind of degree of textual authority while you're creating a script. Yeah, the poisonous bitch will do a lot of damage. She's as clever as a monkey. So right, the next page. I have Rosa starting to talk about some of the major ideas behind her masterwork, The Accumulation of Capital. So she's chatting to her cat and she goes, "Mimi, I'm as clever as a monkey." My historical interest in the subject's been piqued now.
There's a biography of Marx came out a couple of years ago. It's the best one that I've ever seen, by Mary Gabriel. It's called Love and Capital. She reconstructs the Marx family's life as an affinity group. She found this trove of thousands of their letters to each other that were buried in a vault in Moscow, and she had them all translated. Nobody else had seen them, and she was not a Marxist. She was a Reuters reporter, and it's just wonderful.
Well, the Eleanor Marx biography sounds like it covers similar ground, because it talks about Marx's family relationships and wider family, and then centers her youngest daughter, Eleanor Marx, in the middle of it, and then she goes on to experience horrendous domestic abuse, which Rosa Luxemburg does as well, actually. That's an interesting parallel. She has 14 months of sustained stalking by Leo Jurgisches. Rosa Luxemburg's romantic encounters are really interesting, and I set this up in the book. It's like boy meets girl, boy and girl fall wonderfully in love, they've met each other's soulmate, and then you watch the relationship go sour. You watch the ways in which that they're emotionally incompatible with each other. And then he gets sent to prison for 8 years, to Siberia. He escapes. He keeps escaping from Siberia. Amazing guy, Leo Jurgisches. But in the meantime, she's started a relationship with her best friend's son, Kostya Zetkin, and he's 14 years younger than her, which I think is quite remarkable at the time.
You didn't have what Clara Zetkin thought of that.
I kind of think Clara Zetkin had a problem with it, because Clara Zetkin had a much younger husband herself and had faced down social opprobrium for having a much younger lover and had shaken that off. So I don't think she was about to give Rosa Luxemburg a hard time for it. But that, like, if you're going to get into the gossip of German socialists, so we've got Karl Kautsky, yeah? He's a prominent theorist, and he's the editor of Die Neue Zeit, the Marxist theoretical national periodical, yeah? So he's a big cheese. And most biographies, I'm sure, would just concentrate on him. The interesting person is Louise Kautsky. Rosa Luxemburg's friends with both of them. Apparently, Louise Kautsky was really in love with Karl Kautsky's brother. So Rosa Luxemburg encourages Louise and Karl Kautsky, she's got children with Karl Kautsky, yeah, to live in this apartment block where the brother's on one floor and Karl's on the other floor with a different apartments. And so she can live with both of them. I mean, they really practiced their freedoms.
Did that actually occur?
Yeah, it did.
And Karl Kautsky went along with that?
Yeah. I think it was all about freedom in all kinds of ways. I mean, we think everyone was doing it in the 1960s. They were doing it in the 1905s as well, the noughties.
I always thought his first name was Renegade, because Lenin always called him that Renegade Kautsky. For years, we thought that was his first name.
He's not that much of a renegade. I think he's one of those theoreticians who can tie themselves in knots justifying anything. I mean, at the point when the First World War
breaks out. That was the big break in the international and the German party.
He turns around. Okay, so the whole principle of international socialism is that working class people make connections with each other, and that they work on their common cause, and they overthrow the oppressions that they all have together. And the First World War is where that completely falls apart, because you have the working people of one country running into the machine guns of the working people of another country. It's an absolute travesty of the whole principles of socialism. Karl Kautsky turns round and says, "The international is not an effective weapon in wartime. It is essentially an instrument of peace." And Rosa Luxemburg is extremely scathing about that. She's like, instead of the Communist Manifesto saying, "Proletarians of all countries unite," she says, Kautsky would rewrite it, "Proletarians of all countries unite in peacetime, but slit one another's throats in war." I mean, the idea that Kautsky could turn around and go, "Oh yeah, no, socialism was really important, but now we're at war, it's not so important." Luxemburg had the purity of vision to oppose the First World War as part of capitalism and part of imperialism from the outset.
Now, the only one in the German Reichstag, or the parliament, who stood up against World War I and Germany's participation in it was Karl Liebknecht. There were no women in the parliament then, in the Reichstag.
Luxemburg couldn't vote. She couldn't be elected to parliament. In a way, that actually gives her the freedom to oppose what's going on more straightforwardly. Because she had nothing to gain by trying to become popular, because nobody's going to vote for her, because they couldn't. So she was sort of able to keep this purity going. But yeah, Karl Liebknecht is the guy who is the only man in the Reichstag to oppose the First World War. He doesn't do it the first time, incidentally. When they first vote for war credit, it's unanimously in support. But he turns around in December the 2nd, 1914. He's the only guy who stands up in opposition to the votes for war credits.
And he was rewarded by the German government, the so-called socialist government that existed then, being murdered along with Rosa Luxemburg.
Both of them are murdered. I mean, their story is known together. I don't tell Karl Liebknecht's story in particular because I'm just focusing on Rosa Luxemburg. They drop him at the hospital saying, oh, he was shot when he was trying to escape. This is Rosa Luxemburg on the First World War, and I'm reading it to talk exactly about what the First World War was. So it's 1915. The war's been going for a year. Mass murder has become a monotonous task, and yet the final solution is not one step nearer. Capitalist rule is caught in its own trap and cannot ban the spirit it has invoked. Gone is the first mad delirium. Gone are the patriotic street demonstrations, the singing throngs, the violent mobs. The show is over. The curtain has fallen on trains filled with reservists as they pull out amid the joyous cries of enthusiastic maidens. We no longer see their laughing faces, smiling cheerily from the train windows upon a war mad population. Quietly, they trot through the streets with their sacks upon their shoulders, and the public, with a fretful face, goes about its daily task. Into the disillusioned atmosphere of pale daylight, there rings a different chorus, the hoarse croaks of the hawks and the hyenas of the battlefield. 10,000 tents, guaranteed according to specifications, 100,000 kilos of bacon, cocoa powder, coffee substitute, cash on immediate delivery, shrapnel, drills, ammunition bags, marriage bureaus for war widows, leather belts, only serious propositions considered. And the cannon fodder that was loaded onto the trains in August and September is rotting on the battlefields of Belgium and the Vosges, while profits are springing like weeds from the field of the dead. Business is flourishing upon the ruins. Cities are turned into shambles, whole countries into deserts, villages into cemeteries, nations into beggars, churches into stables, popular rights, treaties, alliances, the holiest words and the highest authorities have been torn into scraps. Hunger revolts in Venetia, in Lisbon, in Moscow, in Singapore, pestilence in Russia, misery and desperation is everywhere. Shamed, dishonoured, wading in blood and dripping with filth, thus capitalist society stands, not as we usually see it, playing the roles of righteousness, of order, of ethics, but as a roaring beast, as an orgy of anarchy, as a pestilential breath, devastating culture and humanity. So it appears in all its hideous nakedness. The Unionist Pamphlet, Rosa Luxemburg, 1915.
Kate Evans is the author and illustrator of Red Rosa, a graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg, published by Verso Press. She talked with Mitchell Cohen on Community Radio WBAI in New York. Their conversation has been edited to fit our 29-minute format. Evans is a longtime cartoonist. You can find her graphic fiction and nonfiction books on the website cartoonkate.co.uk. UK. That's all one word, cartoonkate.co.uk. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose online events can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. A video featuring the gift of community radio will be recorded for that site on May 4th, 2024. For more information, email wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.